Hi, I'm Joe Quirk. I talk to Seasteaders and their supporters, and today we're going to talk to two philosophers who invest in technology companies and study the incentive problems among people in governments. And hopefully we'll talk about whether seasteading can be a technological answer to this philosophical conundrum. Reed Spitz, besides being an associate at Formation 8, is also a master's student in philosophy at Stanford. Venture 8 funds companies with the potential to transform whole industries, and Reed has also worked at OpenGov, which provides transparency for governments to share data. Reed at Stanford studied cognition, symbolic systems, the philosophy of Nietzsche, linguistics, computer science, and economics. He's a real Renaissance man, working with some of the smartest people I ever met. Mike Gibson, I first learned about reading Let a Thousand Nations Bloom blog, where I saw he was adept at explaining subtleties I didn't understand in a very clear and evocative way, such that I would suddenly understand it. So I was a fan long before I became a friend. And Mike was working towards his doctorate in philosophy at the University of Oxford before he realized it was all a bunch of propaganda. And then Mike became an associate at Thiel Capital and the VP of Grants for the Thiel Foundation, where he helped run the 20 Under 20 Thiel Fellowship. And now he's co-founder of the company sported on my shirt right now, the 1517 Fund, which is named after a provocative thing Mike said on stage at a hackathon once, which is basically in 1517, churches were selling little pieces of paper called indulgences to save your future. And in 2015, colleges are selling little pieces of paper called diplomas to save your future. And it's all a con to put you in debt. So 1517 invests in startups founded by young innovators who have exited the university system to strike out on their own. And now giving original thinkers the power to exit a bad system and make a better system instead of working within a bad system is what seasteading is all about. And so I'm here because I'm jealous. Reed Spitz and Mike Gibson apparently had a fascinating conversation that I missed out on. And I want to be here where you guys pick up where you left off. So take us back. Where did you guys meet and what did you talk about?
Well, thanks for the intro, Joe. We met at Joe Lonsdale's house at a dinner hosted by Joe for the Seasteading Institute and some visitors from Honduras to discuss the development of future cities or ZAs. I forget what the last English version of it was, the name. But yeah, I can't remember exactly what we were talking about, though.
Well, you know, thanks for having us here, Joe. I think Mike and I were both... dangerous philosophers, we might call ourselves. We both come from the university system and both trained in classic philosophy at Stanford and Oxford. But for one, both like to apply the philosophy that we do to the real world and to the industry that we both are involved with, that's technology. And
I think if I remember now, we were talking about moral judgment.
That's right, yeah, we were having a conversation about morality.
You know, part of these thought experiments that a lot of moral philosophers use to try to suss out their intuitions.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we decided was that a lot of the best research now is in psychology and mm-hmm. anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
So people like Jonathan Haidt, who, you know, actually empirically look at the way people respond to these things.
Right.
And then all the sorts of different attitudes people have that could be by nature, just could be by culture, but like these philosophers in their armchairs, they seem somewhat antiquated compared to some of that new research.
Yeah, that's right. We were basically having a conversation about naturalized morality.
Yeah.
So in any case, it's a pleasure to be here. We're talking about seasteading. And, it's a very exciting project, and I think we both think that there's a potential here to solve some of the big challenges that governments face, that entrepreneurs face.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the diploma as a piece of paper. one of the more provocative pieces of rhetoric, I think, is from a friend of mine who calls the geographical area from Boston to Washington, D.C., the paper belt. So just as the Midwest has been hollowed out and all those old industries are dead and they're referred to as the Rust Belt, similarly, in the future, the paper belt will start to disappear. And why is it called that? Well, because in Washington, they print laws, regulations, visas, money on paper. In Delaware, people incorporate on paper. In New York, New York Times, Wall Street Journal still print on paper. In Boston, MIT and Harvard still print diplomas on paper. So I'd love to burn that shit down.
Yeah, like it's a dangerous philosophy, right?
Yeah, 1517 is part of that, in the sense of trying to create at least a different kind, or support a different kind of path outside the diploma system for people who, you know, maybe just don't fit in, but nevertheless can create value in extraordinary ways.
And the Federal Register requires that it be delivered by courier on floppy disk.
What's that? The Register?
The Federal Register, the federal government sends things to department because there's a regulation. So they literally have to get floppy disks, put it on there, and then have a courier deliver it. So talk about no creative destruction or no incentive to improve.
Right.
And the reason, you know, I renounced philosophers a long time ago, and there's a reason I'm talking to you guys, is because I was... living in houses with graduate students at UC Berkeley. I was at Berkeley like 10 years, not as a student, but as a writer. And I knew philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them told me to my face that, oh, you know, yeah, I teach this stuff. And I'm known as really hard, and it's hard to really get a passing grade. But there's no practical application for this. I think it's all mind games. And I was like, well, how can you do it? Why would you do this? Why would you perpetuate this thing that you're admitting has no point? And then months later, I was in an argument about this problem of colleges getting more expensive and maybe there's a bubble.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he got really defensive and started defending the university system.
Hmm.
So it's like you're saying, all of a sudden, his instinct to preserve his own cash cow came out.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And what I like about you guys is that you kind of saw that and you said there's no point in understanding all this stuff unless you can apply it to the world and transform it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think philosophy, just to speak to the importance of philosophy for a minute, essentially it underlies everything. You know, there's a reason you get a PhD in something, a doctor of philosophy, and that's because if you study something for long enough, you end up getting into questions that are essentially unanswerable at the current moment. They become questions that are too far out into the future to really know. So, but you know, you study any one field long enough, you're gonna encounter those questions and really think about them and apply. I like this phrase about philosophy. Philosophy is the art of applying the minutia of lawyers to the questions of 4-year-olds. So asking these really abstract questions and then applying really robust and difficult thought to them. And so when we're doing what we're trying to do here in the Silicon Valley, which is create a better world and make people's lives better, it's really important to think about the philosophical implications of that and what it really is that we're doing. And so that's why I think having a training in philosophy is helpful. I do think a lot of academic philosophers, I mean, Stanford is very Kant-focused. And so there's a large focus he's basically the father of morality, I sit here as a, what I consider myself kind of a Nietzsche, my focus was in Nietzsche, kind of the classic anti-moralist. And I think, as we're thinking about ways to move forward and about the future, nothing, as Joe and I were talking about right before this, nothing really remains constant in this world. Morality being one of those things. If you think about what morality was 200 years ago versus what moral beliefs hold amongst society today, they're not the same. and the moral beliefs that are going to hold in 200 years from now are not going to be the same. So there's no real fixed point of what is moral, and so you know, that's why it's we want to be thinking about you know, the future and that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think if you break down philosophy by its different specialties, you know, maybe metaphysics and some of the more obscure areas aren't as relevant to Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But front and foremost, I think political philosophy and moral philosophy are, because we can talk about like economics, political science, these are all descriptions of the way the world is.
Mm-hmm.
But moral philosophy is really about the way things ought to be. And so discussing questions about what's important to us, what do we care about, what are our goals, I think will always require some reflection and ways of refining those ideas. You know, I'm not sure academic philosophy is necessarily the sorts of literature and research we want to draw on to answer those questions, but definitely the tradition of philosophy going back to Plato and Socrates. You know, these questions keep coming up.
Mm-hmm.
In technology, inequality, so the labor market is such that you know, rewards go to people who are highly skilled, very technical. The returns to capital keep increasing. Is this driving inequality? What do we do? This is a huge question people are debating right now. Should we provide a guaranteed basic income for people who can't compete with the robots? I think that's a very philosophical question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to me, like, philosophy, the reason I was attracted to it as a student is it's how should we live?
Right.
And you need answers. You need to start acting when you're 18 years old and you're not really qualified to think through all these things.
There seems to be a resurgence of Stoicism. Have you guys noticed this?
So, like, go on.
People like Tim Ferriss are spouting off Marcus Aurelius and Seneca. I forget where I've seen it elsewhere. People are talking about it because I think it presents a way to live. It's like tries to answer that question: what is a good life? What should we do?
Right.
Some of the really smart, successful people that I most respect have confided to me that they secretly read Seneca and Marcus Aurelius.
Really?
And I think it comes from a place of admitting to yourself that if you want to move forward and do the next most important thing for the world, you may have to be humiliated in the eyes of everyone else who doesn't understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's my psychological analysis of the people I know who are reading Seneca.
Huh.
And they do it privately. Like, I know guys that, like, every morning I get up and read a little Seneca to steel myself.
I think, well, we live in, we're in San Francisco. It's a very secular society. People can't reach for, I don't know, the traditional sources of wisdom, like, I don't know, the Bible or other religions. So I think Stoicism presents this sort of secular but deep way of approaching life. You know, I think it's great that people are getting into this because I think there is a lot of wisdom there. And I guess in psychological research, it turns out that a lot of the practices of Stoicism do yield benefits. So, for example, you know, trying to not take... There's this hedonic adaptation that we have where we just grow used to things very rapidly. And we start to take them for granted. And so the Stoics tried very hard to make that go away. And so they had these practices where you pretend like your loved ones have died, or that, you know, your next day might be next week, and so on. And it turns out that those actually work. Part of my... I won't embrace Stoicism, though, or Buddhism, for that matter, just because I can't extinguish my desires, and I don't think I want to. So there's something about, there's almost like a resignation. You know, I think it is good to say, how come I'm not happy with what I have now? Because I could be a lot worse off. Why am I yearning and striving for things and failing, right? But I think to make progress, and this ties back to technology and government, is like, you know, we got to try things. We got to want to explore and do things, and so I don't want to ever give that up.
So what do you want, Mike?
I have this vague sense of progress that, you know, maybe we are meant to explore the stars and not be left on this earth. You know, maybe we are meant to do greater things than just live our lives out on the third rock, right? That I find that compelling. I don't know you know, maybe it's just part of nature to want to explore. We left the savannah. Humans went to Europe and Asia, so just hardwired. I want people to have happier, healthier, fuller lives, you know, full of just the greatest things that life can offer. And so I think I see technological progress, I see good governance as the means to deliver those things.
Is there a great threat to this happening? Like, if you just, why are you putting your shoulder to the wheel to try to make it happen? I think there is a great threat.
I think humanity faces a whole lot of existential threats. I think people tend to focus on the wrong existential threats, by the way. I mean, for instance, global warming is, I'm going to go here anyway. But I think, you know, it's a, look, climate change is a problem, and it's, you know, possible that, you know, water rises and, you know, our coastal cities, face, you know, a lot of challenges in the future. But is this an existential crisis for humanity, or is this, you know, we've got guys like Elon Musk who are trying to, go to the moon and colonize the moon so that, you know, we can save the last human in case a meteor hits or something like this.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if we really, you know, if thermonuclear war happens or something like this, I think there's a lot, you know, bioterrorism.
Yeah.
I think this is a very philosophical question, this, to say, why do future generations matter? And what can we do?
That's right. And what are the existential crises that humanity faces, and to what degree do they, you know, compare against each other, and which one should we focus on?
How do you choose?
And how do you choose? I mean, look, it's important that people are working on all these problems. I think there's a tendency. This is Girard is one of my favorite philosophers who kind of talks about this mimicking that people do, and I think people tend to follow each other in thinking about problems of the world, and the kind of problems that they pick up on are either somewhat random or you know, there's kind of a signaling effect where certain ones get spun up to be really important to the world and to people, and then they just cling on to those as being the most important things we could think about, and everything else is doesn't matter. But, you know, look, we face a lot of problems, and I think it's important to try and figure out what is signal and what is noise.
So seasteading, for instance, I think fits into that view of trying to prevent, you know, some kind of insurance for existential risks of various kinds, right?
So, I mean, I hope I can sum up why I care about it so much. You know, the existential threat of a meteor hitting the Earth in the next 500 years is very slim.
Yeah, sure.
Getting to Mars is very expensive. I'm not urgent on that one.
Yeah.
The fact that there is an ascendant religion of climate change that seeks the solution by further empowering the nation states of the world, that is the superstition that I think is the great threat to this technological thing taking off. So the thing that's driving technology for me is essentially startups. It's an evolutionary process that engages variation and selection. Governments don't vary and select without bloody revolutions. But we could unleash this on the oceans. We could have different kinds of governance emerge on the oceans. So that is a existential threat, in my opinion. It's much more easily solved than going to the moon. Sea stations are cheaper than space stations, as I like to say.
Yeah.
And so that, I think very, we could very easily in the next 50 years have technology locked down by over-intrusive governance that never stops expanding into people's lives, and we end up in a totalitarian world. And I think we could solve it if we proliferate the amount of governance in the world.
There's a lot to unpack there. One thing I like is the people getting wrapped up through some sort of mimesis into caring about or giving way too much priority to the wrong problem. So climate change can be very real, but maybe, you know, the negative consequences are not as extreme as, let's say, the threat of political failure or wasting our resources.
There are debt crises or something.
Yeah, right. And then on top of that, perhaps the answer is as well is something in finance is just portfolio theory. You want as many different opportunities to thrive in an uncertain environment, such that when there is some disturbance, you know, hopefully there's a solution among that portfolio.
Yeah, I mean that's that you want to diversify your risk, right? That's the idea. So that's why you know it's so important to have people working on all these different kind of problems, and you know why having something like the Seasteading Institute is extremely important to the world, because it's a startup, it's an experiment, it's a new way of thinking, it's breaking the mold. You know, we were talking before, Joe, about you know nothing in the world is constant. You know, that things are always subject to creative destruction, as a term we use here in the Silicon Valley, meaning. You know, if you don't continue to innovate and do things better, then you know you're going to go extinct, and that's true not just in technology, not just in business, but biology. You know, just the natural order of things that there's no such thing as constant, whatever. So to be thinking on the leading edge and to be trying to solve a new challenge is something to be revered, I think.
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah.
And it comes from a sense of panic. I mean, if there were 193 companies for 7 billion people
that's good.
Providing something as vital as, what do you want to say, healthcare.
Yeah.
There are 193 companies in the whole world, and they can never, ever change without killing most of their customers. And by the way, you're in that company, you can't switch to any other.
Yeah.
We would have really bad industry in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And... So we're kind of stuck in this old archaic system, these old archaic systems founded in previous centuries. And I think the technology of the 21st century needs governance of the 21st century. And that's why I'm...
Yeah, I agree with
that. Have you guys ever heard of Gordon Tullock's Paradox of Revolution?
No, what is this?
Yeah, so he casts revolution in terms of incentives and collective action problems.
Sure.
So, you know, why don't a large number of people overthrow a bad government and install a good one? And so, let's look at the incentives. For trying to foment revolution,
sure.
You're undergoing a great risk to yourself. You could be imprisoned or killed for taking part in that. Moreover, as self-interested creatures, if we notice other people doing this work, and we stand to benefit, even if we don't participate, people tend to free ride. So if you guys start your revolution, I might see you're doing a good job, so I won't do it at all, but then maybe you start thinking the same way, and you start thinking the same way, so no one does it whatsoever. So the question is, how do revolutions happen? Well, in a bad way, overthrowing states, if you look historically, is that, it's not a widespread revolt of the lower classes or the middle classes. It tends to be an elite group, like Lenin and the other Bolsheviks were a small group who had a concentrated interest, and they gained quite a bit when they overthrew the aristocracy. So likewise, what I like about seasteading, and then certainly within startups and companies, is that a small number of people who are highly incentivized to create value and stand to gain quite a bit, can help solve problems on the margin, maybe one by one. So if seasteading comes into play where you know if the costs are lowered, then you don't need to convince 300 million people or 100 million people. It's just a small number of people. And if they implement some new rule set that happens to be beneficial to the wider world, then they can copy those best practices. And I just find that so compelling. I don't know why people would ever disagree with that.
Yeah, I mean, IBM didn't adjust when the Microsoft guys brought their ideas to them. Mm-hmm. And the Microsoft guys didn't have to take over with guns and IBM and then change IBM from the inside. They broke off and created Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
The people broke off and created Apple.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to win any arguments. You just had to provide the better option.
Oh, that's right. So the traitor's eight. Have you guys heard of this? That's the so William Shockley is one of the most brilliant men of the 20th century, invented the transistor. He moved out to Stanford, lots of speculation as to why, but he started his company, the first transistor company. And he brought with him the best minds that he knew.
That's right.
But this guy, as brilliant as he was the worst boss ever. Whenever there were delays, he'd freak out. He started giving polygraph tests to people. Why isn't this on time? He put up everyone's salaries in the open area, and people would contest it. It was just a nightmare. So there were eight people who worked for him.
So you had Fairchild Semiconductor.
Yeah, they left and started Fairchild Semiconductor, but they just packed up one night and left.
Yeah.
And took their intellectual capital with them. And among those people were Bob Noyce, Gordon Moore, and the people who founded Intel.
Yeah.
So this is just like the classic exit over voice.
Yeah.
And it's, I think, intertwined into the DNA of Silicon Valley. You know, in California, there's studies about, you know, what makes Silicon Valley a little bit more innovative than other places. I guess Boston was competing for a long time. There's a 128 corridor with lots of tech companies. They have universities, government money, so on. So what really made them different and helped Silicon Valley out? I guess one economist, I forget her name, but she pointed out that in California, you can't enforce non-compete clauses in contracts. So if you leave Shockley and start Fairchild, he can't sue you for competing against him. But I suppose in Boston, that you could. To touch on another topic in political theory is this exit over voice as a way to reform institutions and bring change. I think voice is important. I don't want to deny it. Democracy can be quite good, but I think it's made even more powerful if people can just leave.
People can leave and do something better. And nothing inspires someone to do a better job than someone doing a shitty job.
Right.
And I don't want to join McDonald's and change it from the inside. I want to open my own hamburger shop and say, I have a better hamburger. Then you don't need to win arguments. People just choose something better.
Yeah.
And
so Sergey and Larry didn't have to convince Alta Vista or Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
To adopt their search engine. Yeah.
It just goes on and on.
Yeah.
The power to leave and go try something better is what drives progress, in my opinion. And that's the only thing that's not on that train is governance.
That's right. And if you do it with governments, it makes the whole network better. It makes the whole system better. We were talking earlier about, you know, if you have a system where you can just kind of pick up and leave, you know, take your house and go to another node on the network.
Yeah.
Well, talent follows talent. You know, people are going to naturally pool into these locations, and you might see, you know, the people who are the original people in that town, in that city, thinking, well, now we don't like, you know, this, and what's the way to solve that? You go and solve whatever problems were driving people to your city. You go solve those in those other cities and on the nodes. You make the whole network better is the way, and so it's actually, it allows for you know, basically the entire network to operate better.
The more switching and choosing among these things, the less arguing and political growth of political monopolies will have. That's my idea.
Yeah. So why is secession seen as an evil? I mean, I know obviously because it was associated with slavery, which is objectively bad, and the Civil War, but it just seems that there's this hostile reaction to secession movements. Even in Europe now, these Catalonians or Scottish people who thought about leaving.
Well, the third word in the trio is voice, exit, and loyalty.
Right.
And loyalty is such a powerful, you know, I feel like our emotions evolved in tribal societies where you spent your time arguing about social policy and tried to form coalitions and then tried to say the chief is screwing up, we need to depose him and let's have a vote.
Yeah.
I feel like this is what people naturally do.
Yeah.
And that the state has hijacked all these natural moral emotions.
Yeah.
So people that are in the state experiencing themselves as being in a clash with the other group.
Mm-hmm.
There's only two options to every social problem, and we need to be loyal to each other and fight against that other group and divest them of power and take control of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you say, I think the whole system is screwed, and I think me and my friends can go do a better job.
Right.
Matter of fact, I'm going to go deal with those Silicon Valley guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
That provokes people's ire, and I've stared through the face of it many times.
Sure. Well, to go Nietzschean for a minute, you know, we're in need of a revaluation of values, and a lot of people, you know, tend to kind of take these values for granted, take the value of loyalty or the value of, you know, not seceding, that kind of thing, tend to be
Would you classify the people who exit, is this slave morality trying to, the resentment trying to bring people?
I certainly think there's a good, chance that, you know, anything, that any kind of ire that you receive, Joe, probably is somewhat.
Well, how would you guys answer the question if let's say you're a progressive left-wing thinker and, you know, rich people want to leave?
Yeah.
How dare they? You know, what is it? It just doesn't seem fair that, you know, they don't contribute to, I don't know, social welfare and so on.
Yeah, I simply describe reality.
Okay.
I say the U.S. Yeah. government claims the right to tax anyone that goes anywhere, no matter where they go. So if you're a rich person and you go to France and open a business and you make more than $96,000 a year, the U.S. still taxes you and
right.
France taxes you. So there's no danger of the rich people in your country exiting your state. Take it for granted, they claim they own you.
Yeah.
I also point out that just about every Hollywood celebrity you can name owns their own private island. Nobody cares, and they, you know, rarely visit those places, but they have to pay for the people who work there and keep it clean and do the yard work and provide jobs and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, right.
And also, cruise ships are worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and rich people do go on them. They're called middle-class Americans.
Yeah.
So I think the people that make these objections have to face the fact that they are some of the richest people in human history and some of the richest people in the human world right now, and that this is driven by startups, by people breaking away from Europe over and over again in history.
Yeah.
People break away and go form their own thing and make something better that then goes back and affects
them. I think that's fair. People are always going to compare themselves to the, you know, most immediate thing that they might put in place, rather than look at the entire, you know, broad scope of human history and see how far we've come. I actually want to go back to a point that you were talking about earlier, which I think is really interesting, which is modeling incentives as game theory, basically.
Right.
You know, game theory, you can basically model anything as game theory and look at the incentive structure. And I actually took a class at Stanford in the spring, which was basically looking at the game theory of morality. And understanding how moral systems, kind of getting these, getting an understanding of how dynamics shift and why moral systems become, you know, get evolved. And there's a somewhat Hegelian thing here, which is that utilitarianism is kind of a natural attractor. It's a kind of a strong basin of attraction whatever initial conditions you set up in the game. Amongst people, it's very likely that you run the simulation and utilitarianism is the philosophy that will emerge over time. It's actually really, really fascinating.
There's this economist, Mutsukato, I think her name is, she wrote a book called The Entrepreneurial State.
Yeah.
And she loves to rail against Silicon Valley hubris.
Huh.
And one of the things she mentions is not seasteading by name, but technologists living on the ocean, she says, I can't wait till they have to call the Coast Guard to help them. So what is the emotion, right? I mean, so to go to your point, like game theory on, you know, maybe it's not like this consciously driven emotion, maybe it's her sense of fairness.
What I'm trying to say is essentially that sense of fairness that drive towards
it does her well in iterative games.
Exactly. It's a.
Have you ever heard of the ultimatum?
Oh, of course. Yeah. We have a pie between us, and let's say we can split it into 10 pieces, and you have a choice.
I have to. So let's say it's money.
Sure.
Joe gives me $100.
Uh-huh.
I have to propose a split with you.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
If you reject it, we both get nothing.
Exactly.
So, as it turns out, you know, no one. If you were self-interested maximizer,
$1.
You would be willing to take $1. I would propose 99 to get as much as I can.
That's right.
But no one does that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
In the event, in the experiments, people propose 50-50 splits or 60-40.
Yeah.
But no one, and I guess these surveys have occurred all around the world.
Yeah. And no, and this is interesting. So this is they've actually modeled this with computers where they have different strategies for different like players in the game. So they'll put like 10,000 players in the game with different strategies. So, you know, I'll offer 70, you know, one will offer 75 but reject 25 or offer whatever.
Okay.
And then they kind of bump them into each other and match them up, and then over time, they kind of see which ones amass the most and figure out. And so they run these really cool computer simulations. And this
is there a convergence?
Is there a convergence? That's right. And what you know, systems get converged on? And it turns out, as I was saying, that kind of a utilitarian what's you know, maximizing for the entire good, that like people that have that kind of outlook or that kind of strategy in the game tend to do, you know, really well in the game. That's not to say that there's anything actually foundational about that, you know, people's belief in fairness and whatnot.
Yeah.
It's not really necessarily tied to metaphysics, right?
But take us all the different assumptions too in the experiment. It's like,
yeah,
you know, what we earn in this world is not just given to us like manna from heaven. So there's this assumption that our incomes are just, I don't deserve this. So whatever cut I propose, maybe I do deserve 99 and you deserve one. I don't know. It's like, in the real world,
in the real world, there's actual wealth creation. I mean, it doesn't just happen.
Right.
In a vacuum.
But I think there's a sense of fairness and loyalty. You're right.
I think it's
a betrayal.
Like, in order to illuminate the kind of arguments she makes, which completely sway anyone that's a strong statist,
sure.
I translated into my native tongue of New Jersey, where the mafia held sway, and I would say, hey, you're not gonna go form your own restaurant over there in Connecticut. We paid for your restaurant. We helped you out. We pushed down your competitors. We took a little thing from everyone. We provided the protection, and by the way, the crime does go down when the mafia takes over.
Yeah.
When Pablo Escobar took over, the crime went down. And then there's people in that neighborhood who say, you're one of us. You can't, now that you've benefited so much, you can't take the recipes you learned and go somewhere else. To hell with that. I can't wait till you have a problem. Then you have to ask some of my big boys to come save you. Maybe we'll say no.
Yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
And I think it's very tied. You know, it's deeply ingrained in human nature to have these kind of.
Yeah, but I think people pay lip service to loyalty, but you know, the thing for them to do something, if they have something they can exit to, I think they'll take it. Look at Uber and taxi services.
Yeah, sure.
I think the number of people who think we should be loyal to these medallion owners is growing fewer and fewer.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And we don't have to argue about it. That's the great thing, is you just point or you use the service. So Mutsukato or whatever, she can complain all she wants if people leave. Or suggest that they might leave the medallion system or something else.
Yeah, they vote their dollars.
Yeah.
And I would also say that if a seastead starts to sink, it won't be the Coast Guard that saves them.
Yeah.
It'll be the private salvers out there.
Yeah.
Which you
me more about that. Yeah, you've been reading up on that.
So, yes, I can't believe I've been at seasteading so long and I haven't fully discovered this thing. But I kind of want to write an article about this, and I hope you guys can help me with it.
Yeah.
Is I was first introduced. So basically, ocean anarchy already exists. So if your giant ship breaks down in the middle of the ocean, catches fire, starts to sink, and it has $100 million worth of stuff on it, which is a real figure on some of these cargo ships, what the hell do you do?
Yeah.
The Coast Guard can't get out there to save you. And it turns out the seas are just awash with all these volunteer rescuers, private salvers, who come out and will, at considerable risk to themselves and often spending $1 million, will rescue your ship, board it while it's sinking, put out the fire, stop the oil leak, get people off, and then tow it to safety.
Yeah.
And then the question arises, like, why would anybody do all this, and how do you make it right for them? What if it's like, okay, what I just did is worth $10 million, and the ship owner says, I don't have $10 million.
Yeah.
A rule emerged in antiquity that the salver gets right of salvage, to claim a certain ownership of the ship.
Huh.
And so then the question becomes like, well, how much of the ship can he claim? And I was explaining to Reed that in 75% of cases, the ship owner and the salver agree to what that is, because they have these traditions behind them that incorporate all these things. How much risk was there? How many guys did you use? How far out was I? How much was it worth? How much risk did you take? Did you save the environment?
Yeah.
But in 25% of cases, they disagree. Then they have to go to Lloyd's arbitration.
Okay.
Like, Lloyd's arbitration listens to both sides. They'll only listen if you don't bring a lawyer. That's awesome. And then they issue a judgment. One guy says, you owe me 5% of the ship, and the other guy says, no, you get 15%.
That'd be great if we had that in Silicon Valley, by the way, just, you know, we don't have the lawyers.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And
this is great. Wait, so how do my ship's going down? I send an SOS to some Salver.
You send an SOS to the entire ocean community.
Okay.
Salvers pick it up and then they race.
Those guys
their
are fishing.
Asses
they're
off.
On the golf course. They get a beep. They're like, A team comes together
and
they
then they're trying to pay attention to who else is near the first one to get their line on there.
Okay.
Wins, and so you're in a situation where it's an emergency.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be on the horn negotiating. All right, I'll tell you what.
Right.
That looks like,
this is like
not fair.
Airplane going down, the pilot saying, what are you going to pay me to bring
this? right, exactly. And you also don't want to be in a situation where two different salvers get their line on your ship and are claiming it, okay, I get to rescue this ship.
Yeah.
So there's all these complex dynamics, and there's no central authority.
Huh. But people are solving the problem. This is like the lighthouse example for Ronald Coase.
I'm saying,
where for years people thought it was a classic public good, the government. No one will pay for lighthouses because the benefits are dispersed and we can't collect. I didn't pay for it one by one, but it turned out that in reality, people did pay lighthouses and would go out of their way because their reputations were at stake or because they wanted to help the community. So I love it that these armchair philosophers or political theorists think something can't be the case, but so when the seastead's going down, there's already a solution.
There's already a solution.
Yes.
And so here's my radical. So I've just been looking into this, these certification societies and arbitration societies with no enforcement mechanism.
Yeah.
So I was explaining to Reed, it's like, suppose you go to Lloyd's, argue your case, he only gets 5% of my ship.
Mm-hmm.
Lloyd says, no, he gets 25% of your ship.
Yeah.
Suppose you say, well, screw that. I'm just going to go off and do my own thing. What are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And Lloyd says, we're not going to do anything about it. We're simply going to publish our decision.
Okay.
So now the entire industry knows you're the type of businessman
who,
when Lloyd's arbitrates
doesn't
your
honor
dispute,
his agreements.
Doesn't honor his agreement. So everybody hustles to do what Lloyd says.
Yeah.
And so there are certification societies in seafood, in sustainability, in the safety of ships. There's no state involvement in any of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the chapters I want to call is like, how can 140 people control the seafood industry of the entire globe?
Huh.
So there's a seafood certification society. I found out recently, I was telling Reed, that the FDA inspects like 2% of the seafood that comes into the U.S. from overseas. So you get seafood from China, from Taiwan, I mean, all kinds of crazy places. It's just coming in and we're just eating it. Why aren't we all getting sick and dying? Why isn't the FDA protecting us with all the SWAT teams and staff?
Okay, good question.
Well, the answer is, in part, a certification company with 140 people on it who merely has a reputation for holding high standards. And they solicit these places and say, we're going to audit.
Yeah.
You got to show us that every level of your supply chain like isn't using slave labor, that isn't having dangerous stuff in it. We're going to randomly inspect your fish. Turns out 90% of our demands were met, but 10% you failed. Turns out we found selenium in this fish. We're not giving you our certification. Then those companies scramble their asses off to get that certification. And this, I can't remember the name of this, literally a staff of 140 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that's fascinating about it is that there's... there are certification companies all over the world. And there are ship certification companies, of which there are 50 in the world, and 6 just in Singapore. And those certification companies have to compete to be the most respected among the industry competitors who choose them.
Mm-hmm.
They solicit them and say, you know, come on board my ship and guarantee that it's safe.
Yeah.
And they'll say, all right, well, if you want that, then I need my man on your site for 9 months.
Yep.
You've got to set us up with an office. Sure, sure. And so these places will work. We're certified by 8 different things. And this is complete anarchy, in my opinion. It's anarcho-capitalism.
Yeah.
Well, one of the concepts I think you're touching on here that I just love to think about, you know, the term sounds kind of crazy, but hostage capital. So someone told me that they thought reputation is a currency, but I think reputation is a hostage, such that in your interactions with people, they actually have your reputation hostage, And if you don't perform well or and somehow renege on something, they can destroy your reputation. And then you pay the penalty for that, right? And so in those instances that you mentioned, it's like if you're selling fish and you're selling bad goods, it's like you're going to be ostracized and exiled from the market.
Yeah.
You're not going to get, and your reputation's destroyed. Another form of hostage capital could just actually be capital. Like these. So one of the interesting cases, I love the comparison, is governments. How do you make sure governments have their hands tied such that when the chips are down, they don't just expropriate things? Well, maybe the reputation isn't strong enough. So there was this case with international arbitration in Venezuela. So before Chavez came in, I think Exxon was exploring there for oil. They came to an agreement, but they knew that there was regime uncertainty there. So they said, look, if we're going to develop these oil wells, you're going to have to put these bonds up as hostage capital. And in the event you expropriate our wells, we'll go to arbitration, and then the judge will decide, do we get to take the bonds? And so that was all set up. Sure enough, Chavez comes into power. He expropriates the wells. And then the arbitrator decides, yep, you're awarded, and they end up getting some billions back in these bonds. Whereas, by comparison, in the U.S., if you were a stock owner of GM in the financial crisis, you saw that go to zero, and the government wiped you out, and you got nothing. You know, so it's like, if incentives matter, mm-hmm. people in, you know, it's, we can come to agreements now, but how do you make sure that when something bad happens that people go through with it? I think reputation's good. I think there are other forms.
Yeah. This is why I think, going back to the point of why philosophy matters, because we're not just dealing in terms of physical goods anymore. What we're talking about is really metaphysical things here. And
yeah.
We're innovating on metaphysics in a way. Right?
Just by giving names to things.
Yeah, I guess, but thinking through the way that we're doing these things and that's why I think it's good to have a strong understanding of what's going on and innovating on it and thinking about new and creative ways to align incentives, basically.
Yeah.
Because one thing that is you learn early on in game theory is you don't often end up at the Pareto optimal solution.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got just throw 10 agents into a game and you're trying to optimize towards something. It's not likely that the incentives are aligned in such a way that they are. So you have to actually think about how to align the incentives of the agents in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And
I guess you're right. So it could be a form of prisoner's dilemma, right?
Yeah,
where the
yes.
reputation is what makes sure people keep
yeah.
their mouths shut.
Yeah.
yeah.
yeah
I like
different.
The hostage capital. That's
yeah.
a very interesting concept.
Yeah, I
yeah,
think
I like
Oliver Williamson developed that
yeah.
as an institutional economist at Berkeley.
Hmm.
Lots of good thoughts on just how to control government from, expropriating things, violating agreements, because they're actors like anyone else and can be self-interested. So if you're caught in a dilemma with the government, how do you make sure that they behave appropriately?
Yeah,
you go to the government.
yeah.
And it's just, it's like, imagine if you just granted me a monopoly over book publishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're worried that anyone can just publish anything and they might publish bad things. We need to have someone have absolute power. So I would be the state with my
mm-hmm.
bureaucracy
mm-hmm.
over book writing. And, I care about my family and friends more than I care about, serving humanity, even though at first I'd want to serve humanity. Over time, I would give my friend Mike he and I have a relationship. I'd give him a book publishing deal, and I'd say, Mike, come out with a book every five weeks. Who cares
yeah.
if it's any good? Let's charge $100 per book, and people don't have any other choices. But if I'm forced to compete among all the authors to be the most respected reviewer of books,
yeah.
then that's a much more robust system by which the best books rise to the top, and then people
that's
can
good.
Them
yeah,
up.
True. And why not at least try it? I mean, that's we were talking about these armchair philosophers who would rail against the having no state as a foundation here, and but what's the harm in having doing the experiment and trying something new and seeing clearly that it's working at sea now? So
why are things getting worse? Let's talk about political
okay,
decay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, what does Fukuyama have to say about
Yeah, that? I gave both of y'all just a couple chapters to potentially read.
Yeah.
But I recently read this book by Francis Fukuyama, who's a political economist, I think, at Stanford. His thesis, basically, I guess the main thrust of the thesis is that institutions decay over time because this is the kind of point I was making earlier, but nothing is constant. So if you look at when the institutions of the United States were set up, they were set up to be beneficial for the environment in which they emerged. And even though it was kind of a great startup idea and a new idea for humanity, that being said, the way that it was set up, our Madisonian form of government was supposed to work well, for that group. But since 1776, lots have changed.
Right.
Demographics have shifted. We now have two very strong, very polarized political parties. We essentially live in what Fukuyama calls a vitocracy, where we're in the middle of a budget cycle right now where we might not get our budget passed because basically every player in the system can veto at any point the courts, Congress, and the president. And what was a system that was supposed to be set up to allow for some temperament of power of the state has totally crippled the state's ability to do anything. Which leads to just a complete, basically our institutions are in decay, is the argument of the piece. And so the point is institutions, especially government institutions, political institutions, aren't adaptable, really. They get set up. Ronald Reagan has this great quote. Mm-hmm. He said, the closest thing we can know to immortality is a government institution.
Okay,
these things get set up and they can't go away.
Yeah.
We live in a society where we can now send emails and we have private delivery companies, but we still have a post office, which is huge.
Yep.
And there are certain problems around it. You do want to be able to get mail out to the small towns in this country, but you can also do that in a way that aligns incentives for private companies to do that as well. So we waste billions of dollars just on that alone is one example. And we have all these accumulated inefficiencies now. We have so many. If you look at just like who regulates our financial markets, there's 10 regulatory agencies.
Yeah.
And I swear this is true. Congress has mandated that the Pentagon produce 500 reports per year to Congress. 500 reports is more than one report per day. And that's just because they don't go back and retroactively get rid of all the old things that they've required them to do.
Yeah.
So we have all of this just like sprawling spread of
of
just inefficiency and waste and stuff that's happened over time. And that's just what happens with political institutions. And the thing is they bend until they break. As I was saying earlier, in private industry, there's this constant spin-off and new ideation and stuff, and it's nonviolent, and there's this kind of constant wealth creation and stuff, and creative destruction, which really doesn't happen in government, and that's part of the problem is the incentives aren't aligned for them to fix these problems and procure good technologies to help them solve these problems and so on and so forth.
Do you think there's a natural life cycle to political institutions?
Yeah, I think that it's, well...
So think about a company, right? Like the startup phase can be very innovative.
Yeah.
Flexible teams, small, they can adapt rapidly. But as the company, if you look at Google now, it's a 30,000 person company.
Yeah.
And I think their restructuring into Alphabet is in part to try to address this very same problem. Just growing complexity, less control over the employees, how do you stay relevant?
Yeah.
So... if political institutions are the same, what do we do?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's almost an inescapable problem.
Yeah.
But the real problem is, if Google fails, whatever. There'll be some better company that goes along, and all the people that used to work for Google will go work in other places in industry.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of the nature of the life cycle of private companies. And what happens when the United States fails? there's no alternative that we can all just like go jump ship and jump on the new company.
Yeah.
But that's why you need to have that. That's why it's important to kind of have the ability to, you know, switch providers in a sense. Like you can't, you know, switch company, switch governments. Like you
yeah.
can, like you can switch your employer if you're here in the Valley or something like that. Is kind of the idea, right?
I mean, you just used the term jump ship, and I love that. because I think that is what drives innovation and drives
yeah.
good behavior, is the power of the individual to jump ship and choose something else.
Yeah.
And that's why cruise ships don't turn into slave ships, because people choose another
yeah.
cruise ship,
right.
whereas governments do turn into slave ships.
Right.
Yeah, The Invisible Hook, I think I mentioned this at dinner to you
mm-hmm.
way back, is a fantastic book because
yeah.
Peter Leeson shows how there was this liquid labor market in piracy in the Caribbean. And you couldn't enslave people to be pirates because it was a risky endeavor. You had to raid fortresses and other ships. It's very dangerous. You can't have a slave just won't be good at it, let alone do it. So they had to compete for labor, and so they formed these constitutions that were very complex. They had incentive structures,
yeah.
different kinds of rewards for taking different prizes, insurance, so you could get reimbursed if you lost a hand. And the captains were much better behaved by comparison to, let's say, the English captains who could
yeah.
dragoon their crew, and there were less options to exit. It's just fascinating. Another example of just how anarchy or market voluntary solution can be much better than top-down.
I was astonished to learn that all these American values are not American values. They're pirate
yes,
values.
Right. Yeah.
Constitutionalism, democracy.
Who needs Madison and checks and balances?
Yeah, it's way before
Jack Sparrow.
Yeah. And a lot of the pirates were Navy men who said, "Screw this Navy thing. I'm going to go join a pirate ship."
Yeah.
And you can imagine if you're the captain of a pirate ship, you have no state backing you up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You got to work things out with the guys you're in charge of. You got to share booty. They got to respect your leadership. They can throw you overboard if they don't like you. So it created
yeah.
this whole. It was also the earliest, one of the earliest manifestations of, hey, we took over a slave ship. We just freed all these slaves. Okay, you guys are on our crew. You get equal pay, equal vote, and you're equal everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the values we recognize as classically liberal, according to Leeson, emerged on these pirate ships.
That's awesome.
And a lot of these innovations are what drove the innovations of the American frontier.
So how do we strike the Jolly Roger when we can't, you know, when the USG collapses? It's worrisome is that I think you're right. Google can fail and someone else will merge, but with these political institutions, they're what do we do? I mean, California as a state is falling apart.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if you look at the unfunded liabilities in California,
yeah.
I talked to a guy who I won't mention him by name, but he used to work in the California state legislature, and he told me, I'm moving to Austin. Because
yeah.
I'm not paying, I mean, I can see, he's like, I'm a Democrat, I can do math. And he said, I look, project far enough in the future here in California, and I see just in order to pay off what we owe, and we have blank checks. We've basically written up blank checks, and the banks aren't filled with anything other than IOUs. So I'm moving because I know that the taxes are going to have to go up like crazy, and they're already high here in California.
Yeah.
So, you know what? we face major problems, and then what happens?
Notice the exit.
Yeah.
Every time I'm in Texas, I meet people who used to live in California who got the hell out.
Yeah.
So among states,
yeah.
people can exit.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
But, yes, I agree. Governments are monstrosities that have captive customers that they can charge whatever they want.
Yeah.
I'm so frustrated. I just don't know what to do.
I do.
I watched the presidential debate for the Republicans.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do
that. I thought I was watching SNL Jeopardy with Sean Connery. It was that level.
It's become a mockery of itself, our political institution, our political process.
And the time is right because I think all Americans feel this way. I'm not watching this stuff. I don't pay attention.
Yeah.
But the you're not going to have a revolution, a bloody revolution, and overthrow it and then put nice people in the White House.
Right.
But that's not going to happen. What is going to happen is the services that government provide get slowly outcompeted and replaced by better services that they can't control.
Yeah.
Whether it's cryptocurrency or smart contracts, or everyone in the developing world turns to blockchain-based ways of interacting, and suddenly governments can't keep track.
I hope you're right, and that's what we're trying to do here. Many people in Silicon Valley are trying to do here is kind of eat away at the edges of these problems of the. I mean, it's a very similar problem that we were talking earlier about diversifying your portfolio, and, and it's a good way to do risk management. I mean, when we have all of our capital flowing through, for instance, big financial institutions, that's how we get major crashes when all of the money flows through the Federal Reserve and is controlled by the Fed. Then you know that's it creates more of an existential risk than when you have a kind of a diversified landscape of where people kind of put their capital in. And
diversified is the key word.
Yeah.
So let's see what the philosophers think of my simplistic view of the world, which is because humans are selfish and cooperate when it's good for them to cooperate and fight when it's good for them to fight, it's not good to centralize too much power in any particular people.
Yeah.
So a diversity, a portfolio of different things competing to be the solution,
that's right,
and a proliferation of people choosing among them is what engages the kind of Hayekian ecology of intersecting solutions where the best thing emerges that no one's in charge of, like the iPencil or the iPhone.
Yeah.
You know that Leonard Reed essay.
Oh, right, right.
That if you have a general, suppose I just take a general ideology of radical decentralization of all power is the secret to success.
Mm-hmm.
Am I just completely, that's a crazy way to go, because you do need some central authority, some governance.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating question on, to take an example of like, why are there firms or companies? Those are hierarchical organizations.
Right.
I don't outsource everything that I do. I have a co-founder. We have different roles. It's like we had to form contracts every time we wanted to do something. It would just be problematic. So why do these islands of hierarchy exist in a market? It can't all be totally decentralized, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe I would take it further and say... because it does look like over and over again hierarchies naturally emerge, that people are comfortable being inside just like my dogs.
Yeah.
But they're mostly voluntary hierarchies.
Well, maybe there's a way to frame it as there's some optimal size of a hierarchy if it's solving a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we determine that, right? Mm-hmm. Is it something that could be decided from Washington?
Yeah, and what are you optimizing towards?
Yeah. Or hopefully there's some sort of disciplining natural selection process such that these hierarchies that form, that grow too large and become more inefficient are outcompeted or just drift away compared to something that is smaller or whatever. And so I guess the point is if you bring some market discipline to bear on these different sorts of hierarchies and forms of organization, then we know, or at least have a better, more evidence to suggest that it's an optimal form.
Yeah, I mean, I think the evolutionary process has already produced all these interesting little hierarchies in different islands all over the place in society. There's hierarchies everywhere. They're in schools, they're in all institutions.
Yeah.
The thing that's unique about state hierarchies is that they're completely based on force, violence, and the people inside it don't have any other choice. So I think we need a different language of, like, a monopoly of a force hierarchy is inevitably going to become deranged, whereas a hierarchy that has to efficiently serve others outside the institution it has to compete with other like itself in order to survive.
Yeah.
And that everyone in the hierarchy can say, this sucks, I'm leaving for a better option.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to find a concise way to talk about that.
Yeah.
But to make government, like governance,
mm-hmm.
like these kind of hierarchies, is the solution, I think.
Yeah,
And I think that's what seasteading is. That's what
right. I think there are incomplete examples in history. Let's say Europe from 1500 to 1850 or something, where you had all these different competing sovereign states.
Yeah,
They still had a
monopoly in the use of force within their territories, but there was some level of competition, I think, because people could move from, you know, Spanish Jews could move to Holland, like Spinoza,
yeah.
and work on lenses and do philosophy. It's kind of interesting to think about Leonardo da Vinci. That guy was born in Italy, in Florence. He bounced around serving different dukes. He ended up in France. It's like, okay, that's an interesting career, right? And
right.
Just a totally different era compared to now, where labor is just, I don't know, it's tougher to move around from country to country.
I think you wrote about this.
Did I?
At least I was introduced to
yeah.
this period, contrasting it to China.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I read about it in, I mean, it was one of the theories, I think Joel Moyker, in one of his books, Lever Riches, talks about, so to go to political stagnation and
mm-hmm.
institutional decay, like it was a big question why China fell behind Europe around 1500, because they had so many technologies, printing press, or paper, and gunpowder, rocketry, other things, and these large seagoing vessels. I think they were enormous. I don't know
yeah.
how big they were, but they
mm-hmm.
could sail all the way around Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And suddenly, some kind of
sclerosis,
and
yeah.
just the state, through its tyranny or whatever, just all of that kind of innovation withered. And then why did Europe really thrive and become technologically creative? And so I think Moyker's theory was, this competition for talent and technologies in Europe. Each of these sovereigns could draw talent to them. If I invent something in France and it's banned, in Germany, and some duke in Germany thinks it might stand to benefit him, then he would hire me. And that's Da Vinci, right? That
right.
he would just get hired and move
right.
around.
Right.
And no one could ban anything he was doing, digging up bodies and building.
So, I'll tell you, I was completely persuaded by this argument.
Yeah.
Columbus was another one.
Yeah.
Every country was saying, nope, won't fund your trip, nope, won't
okay,
fund your trip.
Right.
Kept switching
yeah.
around, switching around. It went on forever. And then finally there was some political intrigue where someone got the upper hand by funding Columbus, and that's how he went on his journey.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're an inventor in China, which was completely centrally controlled, the emperor said, I don't like it, then that was it. You were done.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a big concern, right? So the to go back to some of these themes is Cardwell's Law, which I don't even... Douglas Cardwell?
Sure. The best description of Cardwell's Law ever written was written by...
okay.
I'm quoting it in my book.
But
anyway, go on.
Basically, no... nation state remains on the technological frontier for long,
mm-hmm.
and so what is it? Why
mm-hmm.
is the big question in history? So you could look at China,
sure.
The British Empire, 1890s, perhaps the U.S. today.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why? What happens to institutions such that where the pebbles accumulate in the stream?
I mean, I think the idea is probably true that that is somewhat of a natural evolution of institutions, any kind of organization
mm-hmm.
of life. There's a certain birth and a life and death of just organizations, right? So that's
and so if we believe that technology, and every economist will agree with this, and we see it in our own eyes, is that technological creativity is responsible for just all the goods and services that we take for granted and that we enjoy, our standard of living, the progress we've seen from 1800, the Industrial Revolution, so on. So if institutional decay destroys technological creativity over time, then this becomes one of the most pressing issues to me.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like, how do we stop it?
I agree.
Seasteading to me is one component of that.
I just read a book that's related to all of this, which is called Triumph of the City by Edward Glaser, who's a Harvard economist. Who basically talks about why the state, why good public administration is so important, because the thesis of the book is that the best invention that humanity ever came up with in the last 5 million years of existence or whatever it
mm-hmm.
is the invention of the city.
Right.
Because what cities are is essentially, they highlight all of the best things about humanity. You know, the way that new ideas get formed is essentially the recombination of two old ideas. And when you throw a lot of people together into these close quarters, you have the potential to really highlight all of these amazing things. We were talking earlier about Florence. You know, that you think about the Renaissance and the artistic revolution in Florence in the 14th century, 14th, 15th century. You think about I think that this may be a little Silicon Valley centric, but the Silicon Valley, you know, in today's world, right, where we've got these amazing entrepreneurs and technologists come together and form new ideas and all this stuff. But why you need good public administration that sits behind this is because city life can either be the best form of living for all of for humanity, and it can be, or it can be literally the worst, you know, where, you know, you can either have urban splendor, which would be like in New York's Fifth Avenue, or urban squalor, like
Tenderloin,
Detroit, or something like that. Right?
Well, yeah, okay, so here, cities are institutions that are remarkably resilient.
Yeah.
And I look at Rome, has been around for 2,000 plus years.
Yeah.
Athens. One of my favorite comparisons, and it's horrific, but you can, if you look at Hiroshima today, it is thriving as a metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of commercial activity. It's just doing really well, and it was nuked.
Yeah,
it got to be a startup.
Yeah, and Detroit is worse. It's
like
bad governance is worse than getting nuked. I mean, not with the bad, that obviously hundreds of thousands of people died, and that's horrific. So
yeah,
but it's like, wow, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, people and their rules destroyed Detroit.
Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
I completely agree with this assessment. Like, I consider Germany and Japan to have dominated economies and markets and industries 25 years after they were allowed to be, after they had got to be startups,
because
they were bombed to the ground.
That's right.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone else was stuck with their old institutions.
That's right. Yeah.
And so governance startup, I really do think this is an example of how that's more powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why Hong Kong is powerful. I try not to use the examples of people that had atom bombs dropped on them and had to deal with Dresden and
the
Holocaust.
Yeah, the fire bombs, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Germany lost like two generations.
Wow.
And then basically completely started over.
Wow.
But it shows how resilient cities are. To
given
the right rules.
Yeah, then you bring new ways of thinking.
Yeah, talking earlier a little bit about what you were saying about trying to find kind of the optimal hierarchy, you know, the optimal level of hierarchy that kind of allows for the maximal explosion of this ideation, wealth creation, and that kind of stuff, and technology may well be the city, you know, at the city.
Yeah, okay, so that's a great question. Is what is the most important political unit in the future? Is it the city? Is it the nation?
Yeah.
Is it the state?
Well, what's interesting is that over the course of human history, it's in flux, right? I mean, various points in human history, it has been the city, and then we've moved to kind of nation states. Arguably today, it's broader than the nation state. It's you know, NAFTA, the EU, kind of these broad coalitions of you know, nations.
If I answer this question in 20...
Yeah, but what is it?
2050, how many
right.
political units are there? Are there 193?
Or is there one?
is there one? Or is there 500 or whatever?
Yeah.
Define political unit.
Nations, we'll go with some more comparable, so Singapore would count.
So, like, a corporation's not a political unit.
No.
So you basically mean states.
Countries, yeah. How many countries?
So I think I have the feeling we're all in agreement that if there's 10,000, it's way better than if there's 50 or one.
Yeah. One would be the worst.
Yeah,
one would be the worst, and 10,000 would be the
worst. But, okay, in the time back to existential risk, I think the one driver that might bring us one world government is existential risk, where if you look at nuclear controls, start to think about things like bioterrorism. Terrorism is like, it's all pushing towards.
But isn't that as itself an existential risk? You know, like people, it's kind of, people want to drive towards that thing, and there certainly is a tendency towards centralization and towards, basically towards centralization of power. But isn't it better to have various groups of people,
How will we stop terrorists wielding nuclear weapons and bioterrorism if we're all separate states?
Yeah.
I think that's the argument.
Yeah, but here's the thing is, like, terrorism may be one of the existential crises. I've been reading a lot about artificial intelligence lately.
Okay.
And this is a really interesting space, I think, because It depends on who you're reading. So Kurzweil, for instance, who's engineering, head of engineering at Google, thinks that we'll reach the singularity by 2049.
Yeah.
Which is essentially means that we'll have created artificial superintelligence. So take all of the knowledge of all of humans, basically, give it the processing power.
Yeah.
Basically, take the knowledge of the internet, and give it the processing power of all the computers in the world. And that's what artificial superintelligence is. And so, and then it's a question of, like, how cheaply you can create this technology, why it's important, who owns it is really important, because you want, and this is, again, why philosophy is important in these kind of questions, but you want people who have, quote unquote, good intentions to kind of own the development of these things. You want to be really smart about the way you develop these things. This is one of these kind of existential
risks. So we're not caring about the right problems.
Well,
we?
Maybe, no, but the point is, look, if this becomes something that terrorists can make super cheaply, it doesn't really matter if we have one big nation state. I mean, there's other factors at play that we...
It's getting a lot of press. Elon Musk
thinks
that AIs are the threat of the future.
Yeah.
Stephen Hawking.
Yeah. As a species, we got pretty lucky. I think that nuclear weapons are just expensive enough to develop that, you need a kind of huge collaborative effort at the level of a nation state to be able to do it, because it is an existential risk for humanity, and if it falls in the wrong hands, it does. But the next giant invention that could wipe out humanity might not be so expensive and might not be so hard to produce. So,
there's lots of things you mentioned that I like to think about. I mean, the existential risk from AI is a very big topic.
Sure.
In San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of the people who spend their lives devoted to that question, they almost laugh at the stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, probably so.
It's like we're taught, if super intelligence comes, it's going to just turn us all into paper clips and destroy the whole universe.
Yeah. I take this moment to plug Monica Anderson's theories of artificial intelligence. She's the co-founder of Sentience, and she offers the alternative view that this this idea of all-knowing, godlike super intelligence is flawed. Nevertheless, she's working hard to unleash it.
I mean,
but it would,
she's certainly not alone. There are plenty of technologies. I think that it's, I think Kurzweil's prediction of 2049 is crazy. Like, I don't think that there's any way.
Nick Bostrom published a book. I think he surveyed a number of experts in the field.
Yeah,
and everyone suspects it's way off. But then again, predictions that, if you looked at the predictions from 1900, they never thought they'd be able to split the atom or anything like that.
Yeah,
exactly.
Heavier than air machines.
Right,
to fly.
That was Lord Kelvin.
Yeah.
Who's one of the smartest people of the 19th century, right?
But somehow I'd never seen a bird.
when you're thinking about questions of existential risk, though, it just seems simplistic or reductionist to me it seems gut wrong to think that the best way to solve for those is greater centralization. I mean, I think that there's a risk around too great of decentralization too. I mean, that's the whole idea.
I heard some bigwig VCs, they want Washington to pass regulations for AI companies.
Really?
They think it should be regulated as harshly as nuclear companies.
Reed, what do you think of the powers of what are the vulnerabilities of too much decentralization?
That's a good question. I guess it depends on what problem you're trying to solve, right? So I think we keep talking about this idea of the best way to manage a portfolio is to have a lot of different investments in that portfolio. That's the best way to manage a risk.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're trying to manage the existential risk to humanity, if whatever, first of all, there's a lot of problems that humanity faces. And so you want to have different ways of thinking about all those problems and different ways of solving all of them. And I guess my thought is you want to try as many things as you can. Like, you want to have a bunch of different experiments and something will work. And so it may be the case that, for instance, when it came to the nuclear invention of nuclear weapons, It's a good thing that we had the United States there and that like created this.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that's something that would have been possible without kind of that kind of scale of capital investment and incentives behind, you know, defeating the axis of evil and so on and so forth and war. So that's like one example where it's probably a good thing we had that much centralization. And there are plenty of examples where it's clear that like we're over-centralized in our banking system and our regulatory environment and various things. So yeah, in our money. So that's why I guess my thought is like, I don't know what the right balance of the mix is for your portfolio. And it's like an infinitely complex problem because there's all of these challenges and there's all of these ways of thinking about solving all these things. So there's like portfolios within the broad scope portfolio, but yeah, I mean, I guess the risk around over decentralization is you may be lacking the ability to tackle some of these problems in some other ways. So yeah,
because I think of seasteading as the radical decentralization.
Yeah, which I think is true, and I like that. I mean, I think that's a necessary component.
But you know, however many people in the world, let's just say 7 billion in the near future, I don't know what it is, but there shouldn't be 7 billion countries.
There shouldn't?
Or shouldn't there? The sovereign individual?
What? I'll do is, why not?
Too much decentralization. Are there public goods that we wouldn't be able to create or provide?
Well,
Every man is his own country?
Well, if on the sea, everyone operates as their own country, and we do have environmental protection among the salvers.
Yeah,
that would be a form of, you know, free market provision of environmental protection. Just knowing these arguments are more complex.
Yeah.
Just I can usually come up with an example of what if we lived in a world of 7 billion sovereign individuals and no. No centralization of coercive authority, but centralizations of other kinds of hierarchies, like the ones we were talking about.
Yeah.
Would that world work better than the one we have now?
Yeah, I don't know. What would be a counter argument? Something like an asteroid striking the Earth, that's a problem. It's
yes.
A public good.
Right.
How do we deflect it? And so are 7 billion people going to collectively act?
Well, I do know this. Was it like, what was it, 15, 20 years ago?
Yeah.
The asteroid came and it passed between the Earth and the Moon.
Yeah.
And nobody saw it coming until it was passing. So the governments in 1995,
yeah,
or whatever this was, did not protect us from,
yeah,
the big friggin' dinosaur asteroid. Now, granted, there's a lot of space between the,
yeah,
Earth and the Moon. But yeah, I remember reading this in the paper.
So that's incredible.
Something the size.
There is an organization, the B16. Oh man, what is the name of it? Foundation. They're trying to get enough money to launch a satellite in a solar orbit, so that it can track all the asteroids in the solar system. So I wish them well. We should get them money,
yeah,
privately.
Yeah,
get people to volunteer cash.
We like those guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
I think Musk and Musk's competitors will solve the problem quicker.
Yeah.
Than,
yeah.
Some politicians.
They may actually use it for resources too.
Yeah.
Cool.
How are you guys doing? You feel good about this?
I think it's awesome, man. I really enjoyed the conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Sweet.
Well,
let's call it a day.
Thanks, Mike
yeah.
Gibson and Reed Spitz. That was a very enjoyable conversation. And I
thank
hope
you, Joe. Thanks for all the good work. And keep it up. We are big supporters.
Thanks.
So.
Thanks, guys. It's nice to have you on our side.
Yeah.
Anytime.
And I'm big supporters of everything you guys do.
Thanks a lot.
See you next time, everyone.
Cool.